Okay,
so to the second part of the first class, what I still quickly want you through is what we do in the second half, and then we'd actually want to do something which is about clickbait. So briefly, the second half, we will talk after break about social networks and online dating. So when we talked about social search, that I know you had in mind already. And there I will focus on a paper by Mark Smith, which will be online, or which analyzed the email behavior between people. So Mark only looked at header information, and by looking at header information, he tried to figure out how should I prioritize emails between people. So for instance, if I've never gotten an email, but you know Miao, Ming Yao, for instance, and Ming Yao sends me email, then I'm higher ranked, you are higher ranked through to me than if we have nobody in common who I have talked to before. I was thinking, I've worked with a couple of dating sites. So dating sites are actually quite interesting. What I might bring out here is the difference in this case between maintenance and discovery. So maintenance means, for instance, Facebook is a good example that you primarily try to sort of maintain your friends and you want to know what's happening there. I think 70-80% of all Facebook contacts are people who you actually know in person. And that's very different if you go to your favorite dating site, because most of you are not interested in maintaining your circle of friends there, but most of you are interested, well, laughing, I mean, right? But most of you are interested in maybe discovering somebody. And so that is a spectrum. So when we talk about social networking sites, it is very important to understand that these are very different which we're talking about here. And there is another paper, the second half of the quarter, we'll talk more about papers and ideas, which is by papers at the University of Washington, and it's more of a business paper. After all, e-business is part of the title of this class. And what Pedro says is there are two elements to customer lifetime value. One element is the amount of dollars which Amazon.com is getting out of my own pocket. That is the intrinsic customer lifetime value. But in some cases, that's more compared to the customer network value. So for instance, if I tell you, you asked about textbooks, if I tell you, oh, you've got to buy all the textbooks I'm assigning for this course, then I have a much higher customer network value by getting here the 50 of you to each buy 200 books than my own value is because I don't buy 200 books a year. So that is another element on social networks. The third one is I had Reid Hoffman from LinkedIn coming to class maybe 3 years ago. There's some very interesting economics elements going on in social networking sites. I'm not talking dating sites right now, I'm talking professional sites. LinkedIn. Who knows LinkedIn? Okay, great. It's funny. I have not had that many hands up in this case. People want to have jobs, something like that. So LinkedIn, as you know, has the following problem. That, let's say Jeff is the CEO of Amazon. He has very little incentives to hang out at LinkedIn and see who wants to work on. On the other hand, if you're interested in getting a job somewhere, you have high incentive to hang out there. So how can we solve this problem? I talked about the economization of life at the beginning of class. How can we solve this economic problem? That we should, for instance, if you really would love to work at Amazon, that we give you a chance to get Jeff's email. And I worked with Dan Alighieri, Match.com, and one of the ideas we had there was, Dan's idea actually, to be clear, was to come up with a heart a week. Not like Friday.com, for instance, where you can send as many hearts as you want. But at Match.com, you can only send one heart a week. And so you realize that that is an important thing for you, that you get through to that guy. How would you want to, should you be able to collect those hearts over time? A good question. Should we be able to bank them? Should we be able to trade? Maybe not. Because otherwise, it's again back to the money economy. That those guys who can buy many hearts, those will then say, oh, maybe it shouldn't be LinkedIn, it should be whatever, the silver bullets. Those guys who actually have the money could buy them. So it's very interesting to set up these incentives. So one of you said, she's in economics, you right? These are very interesting things, and I hope to be able to talk about some findings and behaviors in that class, where we talk about social networks. Homework there will be to read Dan Ariely's paper on online dating to read Mark Smith's paper. Then class 6 will be about collective intelligence. What is collective intelligence? I've set up a couple of things already, so you actually do those things in practice, like the class wiki is an example where you all contribute. Collective intelligence is other examples. How can you detect buzz? What algorithms are there to find out what's cool? I know a VC who has spent millions of dollars just for himself to get somebody to write a good engine for him, which actually will the new trends because they missed the MP3 trend like, you know, 10 years ago. So he wants to know, where is cool stuff happening? What are people talking about? A beautiful example of combining human intelligence, him using his judgment as a VC, with machine intelligence trying what's coming through. Google Zeitgeist, I don't know how to say this in English, Zeitgeist probably, has an example of what's hot, what's not. So class 6 will have some papers on prediction markets, sometimes also called decision markets. So if you set up a market where people can bet on, for instance, the outcome of a baseball game or whatever people play here, or they have elections in America, even if only whatever 20% vote, they do have elections here, right? Occasionally. Okay, yeah. So you could have, for instance, that people sort of offer a contract, let's say $100 worth. I give you $100 if whatever president will win. And you say you buy that contract for $20, essentially express a probability. So the Iowa electronic markets about 15 years ago were the first where people used prediction markets to get to what people really genuinely believe about the future. And much more powerful than actually using elections where you just have a small sample, often very biased, of those people who actually care about something. Who of you actually has used the prediction market? Hollywood Stock Exchange, Yahoo has some internal ones, Google has some internal ones. Who of you has a prediction market? No? Yes.
I used the Google's internal market when I was working.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about it?
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it.
Say again?
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it.
Okay. Okay. Can you find out?
Huh?
Can you find out whether you want to talk about it? Whether you can talk about it?
Okay.
Okay, good. I mean, I'm telling you guys so many stories about all kinds of things, so. Good. Then we move to class number 7. Class number 7 is going to be about recommender systems. I know that if you hear data mining e-business, half of you think this class is about recommender systems. People bought X also, but people bought X also looked at Y, and stuff like this. And I deliberately pushed this towards the end because ILI is only a small fraction of what this class should be about. That class number 7, what I will have assigned is a paper which came out about more than 10 years ago, about the communication of the ACM, which has a couple of good people wrote it, among Ryan, who did work at Google as a consultant, teaches at Berkeley. And I want you to think, when you read that paper and compare to some very recent recommender systems, what really has dramatically changed in that decade. So you managed to get the PDF. I'm not sure whether we're officially allowed to put it up on the website, but we decided to put it up, and I know you'll all visit me in prison when I get to put in prison for infringement. So we will have that, and it will be very interesting, I think, for you to reflect on. 10 years is a long time in the day. What has actually happened in those 10 years, and what has not happened? How many of these promises they had have been realized, and where have truly different things happened expected? Just in a nutshell, recommenders 0.0 were you going to the library, and the librarian says, maybe you should go over there. I think there's a good book on this topic. This was recommenders 0. Recommenders 1.0 were based on statistical aggregation. So, for example, if you take the so-called item filtering Amazon.com uses, you fill a huge matrix. It's a matrix of people. And it's a matrix of items. It's about 100 million people and about 20 million items. It's a very sparse matrix. That's what has, well, what should go in there? What do you think? The rule at Amazon is that any action within 24 hours is that matrix. So if you look at one thing yesterday, another thing tomorrow, it doesn't enter that matrix. But if you look at one thing and another thing in 10 minutes, then if it's the click matrix or if it's the click purchase matrix, it enters that matrix. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you did in the past. It only matters what you do within this persistent 24 hours. That's a pretty poor man's version of what you could do. Because people always think that it knows something about you, bullshit. It knows nothing about you. It just knows something about people who also clicked on that item. It knows what they did within 24 hours of clicking that item. So that's what item-by-item filtering is about. Yet these recommendations are pretty powerful. About 20% of Amazon's revenues are due to people clicking on recommendations with such a simple algorithm. So a couple of billions of Jeff Bezos' wealth is due to that algorithm. But if we look there, a lot of work has happened in the last 10 years. For instance, here in computer science, Daphne Koller's group has developed these relational probabilistic models. Has anybody of you heard about that? Relational probabilistic models? Okay. So you've heard about everything, whether it's Facebook or Google prediction markets or relational probabilistic models. Do you want to teach? Shall we swap? So the basic idea is that this poor matrix knows nothing about the product but what ASIN, what Amazon standard inventory number is. How sad. Because there's much more about it. For instance, whether it's a book or underwear, whatever. So by using, for instance, the relation structure in the relational database, which is behind that ASIN, you can already learn a lot about the item. I live with probability 90% in that class as a guest speaker, Bruce D'Ambrosio. Bruce used to be full-time faculty professor at the University of Oregon, at Oregon State University in Corvallis, but then really worked very hard on these algorithms and Christian started a company called Cleverset, which is the best implementation of these recommendation algorithms, which you can buy anywhere. Buy them, but you can get them and hundreds of companies use them in a software as a service way. I'm also considering of getting again to class Neil Hunt from Netflix, because Netflix had that contest last year. They said, hey, you know, if you can increase our recommendations by more than 10%, then we'll give you $1 million. And I think it was the best marketing campaign ever. Because it was pretty clear that if you have the problem of recommendations, the problem is not the algorithm. The problem is that you cannot evaluate the algorithm offline. Given that you have a high dimensional space, 20 million items or all, it's very difficult to evaluate this. You can only click on what you're being presented on the page. The only way to really make improvements on recommender system is to make them in real life and then to measure the improvement. So it was clear to me that nobody would be able in an offline some data come back with an algorithm to make a 10% improvement, which indeed was the case. Nobody was able to. But I have to say it was a really great PR campaign. I mean, I can't count how many people emailed me about it. Hey, Andreas, it's good. Bruce was one of them and said, Andreas, no problem for us to do this, but for a company which market capitalization is way more, or which value is way more than $1 million, why would we hand over our soup to Netflix for a $1 million price? So I haven't decided whether I ask you, the CEO or the chief product officer of Netflix. It's hard sort of to say these things, you know, in a really neutral way. But it could be an interesting conversation, let's put it this way. Topics are here not only modeling products. This here, this item-by-item filter, is about modeling products, modeling the co-clicking behavior. It is also about modeling people. Modeling people is very closely related to a big area which has not been solved yet, which is that of reputation systems. And reputation systems at the heart is persistent identity. So if you think about reputation systems, what comes to your mind?
eBay. Okay, so there's not much of a reputation system at eBay, not much of machine learning there. It's just transparency, which allows you to see what has that guy done before. So a very successful algorithm of making money on eBay is you sell something for $1, you sell something for $2 or $2.50, you really create a good history, and then you sell something for $10,000 and you never deliver on that. That, for instance, is a very good way of using eBay, right?
That's actually my job.
Sorry, a secret.
I can go in more detail, but probably 30, 40 people just writing algorithms to just catch these kind of fraud patterns. So it's a huge, huge interesting pattern.
So the point I wanted to make is eBay creates a reputation system basically by creating transparency. And I deeply believe transparency is a good thing because you can actually have your own ideas about what's happening. You can have your own stories about the data you observe if you're given the data. A reputation system should be potentially more just creating transparency. But transparency for me is 90% of getting there. For instance, at Amazon.com, where you have reviews, or for instance, at say LinkedIn, where you can rate people, I think, or maybe at OpenBC, we'll see. Let's say for the moment, it doesn't matter what company it is, we can all give tags to each other. Tags are just words or how we label each other. And if you want to see a funny movie, no point in showing it to you because the projector doesn't work. If you enter Supermarket 2.0, it's a really funny movie where they take the Web 2.0 concepts and apply them to a supermarket. So Google Supermarket on YouTube and you have a 5-minute movie, which is really funny. So taking those concepts, if you all tag, so I give you a tag. So maybe you like the tag, then you leave it. Maybe you don't like the tag, then you want to remove it. But now what should happen? I forgot your name.
Jerome,
okay. What happens if Jerome removes the tag, I and Resi? If it's just gone, that's not enough because we want to have transparency. So if you go to Jerome's page, it should say tag. Here was a tag Andreas gave to Jerome, and Jerome removed that tag. And by people moving, click on that, they see, for instance, statistics of how many people remove tags I give them. So if usually I give very good tags to people, and there's one Jerome gets who he's not happy with, I have much more credibility with him than if 99% of all the tags Andreas gives to anybody just hates the world and thinks everyone is an idiot, get removed. So if you think through reputation system, transparency goes a better way. But there's still something you build on top of that, and that's what I will do in that class. Which brings me to one point there which we want to talk about, which is to talk about pseudonyms and about the price of privacy. Pseudonyms, so there are three ways of authentication. No authentication is anonymity. Who would use anonymity? In which situations would you use anonymity?
Search.
What's it?
Search.
Search, okay. So you want to do anonymous search and forego the wonderful ability to look up the searches you do down the road. I searched for that Gino, what did I find? Or what? Yeah, it won't happen. Or for instance, let's say you are using this example again in Singapore and you see somebody who's chewing gum. So you want to report them to the police, and maybe beaten up by his friends. So that would be an example of making sure I'm reporting this person having this chewing gum in a public hotel room. And that way you want to have anonymity so that you don't want them to find out who you actually are. So if you see crimes, then anonymity might be a good thing. But I can't think about many more things where it might make sense to actually use anonymity. To the other spectrum, the other end of the spectrum, which is strong authentication. At Amazon.com, I had debates with Jeff Bezos on whether or not to use real name authentication. So if you go to Amazon.com page, then you see that some people are there with their real name. And that means the real name is the one as it appears in the credits. It's actually easy for a company like Amazon because there are real packages get delivered to real people in the real world. So in that case, real name is possible. Now, I have to confess, if I think the book written by the guy next to me in the office, I mean the office next to me, is actually not really cutting it. Maybe I would do it under a review. But I don't want to do this under his real name, and you know that's the end of him greeting me on the corridor. I do it under the pseudonym, and you look up my other reviews, because pseudonyms have persistent history, and you feel this Andreas guy is a reasonable guy as far as you know his reviewing statistics books goes, then you trust much more that review, and I don't have the barrier of actually telling the world that this is me and this is the guy next door in the office and I really disagree with this chat table. Maybe he doesn't actually read much. Maybe that's what's happening. So here's an interesting story about Amazon. Amazon has this policy that you can actually review things with your pseudonym. And then one day, 1.5 years ago, there was a little bug in the system in Canada. And unfortunately, instead of showing the pseudonyms, it showed the real names right away. It was surprising, as I'm not telling you secrets, I just found out how many of these really glowing positive reviews about books were written by the authors themselves.
And then the very last class, we'll be talking about modeling situation and modeling location. So
just to contrast those two, we want to be doing recommendations because recommendations are an important part. Recommendations can be product recommendations and people recommendations. And I actually assigned a book chapter for a book which hasn't been published yet, and I'm still waiting for permission from O'Reilly, called Collective Intelligence, which has a very good chapter on this matrix. I think Art's class also basically deals with that. What about this?
Transposable data.
Transposable data. Not disposable stuff, but transposable data. Unfortunately, Art's class are also some of our class, so you can't go to both. So for this transposable data, the other direction you can project things out is about people. So you can do recommendations in modeling people. And you can do recommendations by modeling products. Since I like to draw pyramids, let me draw you another pyramid here. We tried to do this with a projection because these are big slides with big letters. Can you just get the screen down again? Do you still need signal from me, or are we live, more or less? You should have signal by me. It helps to plug in the projector, actually. This is my mistake. Okay. So basically, this is readable, and the reason I have Chinese is just, you know, for the Chinese of you, in case you don't know something, I guess. It's from my team. So there are four levels here. The bottom level is that of a page. You combine pages and visit. Okay, a visit is a sequence of page, and a session is a sequence of pages. You then combine a visit over time with a customer. And you combine customers to get to network of customers. So I'll go through those four stages here and talk to you about the analysis we can do and the actionability you have. So on the bottom level, on the level of the page, you can model as the content of the page. And there is a very interesting new company called Turn, T-U-R-N, which is which is done by the CEO of AltaVista and the CTO of AltaVista, also with Xerox PARC. And what they do is a very new way, actually, of doing the modeling of the content. But of course, the canonical way of doing it is with Google AdSense. What are ways to actually characterize the page. You do essential information retrieval. You could look at the links which go into the page. You could look at the link out of the page. You can look at people who actually visit that page. All the beautiful things you can do by collecting click data and by collecting content data. But all the slides I have are on the web at viagen.com/teaching. So if I change something, I'll update it. Right now, they're all about the set I just did last month. So everything I show you, if you just Google it with any of these words, you'll have the slides come up. Second level is a visit. So you combine individual pages to a visit, and a visit typically is defined as half an hour of inactivity. So a visit is something which is very much server-centric. So you sit at a server, you are the server, just imagine you're a server, okay? And you dish out pages to somebody, and if the guy doesn't come for a half hour, then you say, it's over. And that is the server-centric notion of a page, of a session. When you are in sessions, there is a lot of modeling you can do. Among the modeling you can do is you can figure out what is the intention that you have. What's the situation he is in? What's the modality or the mode there? For instance, is it a planned impulse? Is it a planned visit? No, they have been planning to buy that Canon 5D for a long time and now they are ready to cough up the $2,000. Or is the impulse visit? Hey, you know, I'll just pick it up on the way. Is it a personal job related visit? Is the person in the hurry, as I always am, or they have time to? Are they ready to make the decision? So for instance, if somebody comes in to Amazon.com and they come in from a comparison site, from a price comparison site like shopping.com, then you know they are probably in a different mindset because they are price sensitive. Than to somebody who comes from, let's say, DP Review or some site, maybe somebody says, you know, here I'm a holiday picture, or they come in from Flickr where people now have camera links and stuff like that. So that one you can get from and what the data is. The third level here is that of the customer. And I will talk about the comparison of these levels in a minute. The third one is really, who is the person behind it? Traditionally, in the pre-directional communication world, in the world which was not characterized, but what we have now, namely the cheap ability for me to get the response to what I'm giving to you. Traditionally in that world, that's all we had. We knew that somebody is living in 94114, which is it. And people 94114, we should send them this kind of marketing material, they found out. Capital One, credit card company, was extremely good in developing experimental methodology of having all these 20,000 sales in the United States and then knowing exactly what offer they should send to somebody in a certain city. So it's called personalization-based marketing. What I said before, the fact that you go on the travel site and you're interested in something means now Yahoo is going to show you travel ads. The difference between the visit and the level for online marketing is that on the visit level, we don't have to have any idea of your history. You come in, we look at where you're coming from, and we show you stuff we think is relevant to you, based on where you came from, based on how quickly you type, based on your etc. No need for your history. Easy from a database perspective. This one is hard, because we need to look up in real time, Gino, what has he done again before, out of 20 million people. And now what should we recommend to him based on the past? Sure, some of those things can be pre-computed in both cases. Here, we can have a few models which fire off certain things. And here we can say, when Kiat is coming to our page the next time, we will show him, you know, those travel books. But in general, these are very different sets of information and very different models you build in those two cases of the customer. At Amazon, I build about 500 fields for each customer. And here are some of the attributes which we have. How influenceable is the guy? So if we show him something, he knows he wants to buy that camera and he's not going to click on anything else. Or hey, there's a four-wing grill, how about the grill? You know, I can't even read it from here, this is awful. How is the patient style? Is he, for instance, primarily a person who browses? If we show him a click, he will click on it. Or is he like I am searches? This, by the way, a very consistent behavioral trait of people. what I did is I looked for customers onto, and now apologize to the online people who can't see what I'm drawing here.
Maybe I go to.
I looked at the log of the search divided by the browse six people did. So if the log is zero, then this means they search as much, they use the search box as often as they click on links. And then over each person, you get a certain distribution. And my case, you know, it sits on the right. In other people's cases, it pretty much sits on the left. These all stand the browse. In my case, no hope to getting me to click on a thing. I'm just a search guy. So this characteristics here, as we said, of the people. Early adopter, Jeannie Pan, who was an undergrad here at Stanford, right, 2 or 3 years ago in computer science and is now running forecasting at Amazon, was an intern of mine, and he did a beautiful finding out who are the early adopters. Who are the people who, just the moment a product comes out, you want to have, and what add them. Leaders versus followers. What is people's attitude to complexity? That is a very open question. Let me give you an example from Dragos. You know Dragos? Dragos is an upscale market in Menlo Park. And what they do at Dragos is they sell jam. Okay? So here is a picture of jam. It's not from Dragos, but I took this picture because it has 6 jams in it. I'll tell you about an example from behavior economics. So behavior economics is a field where people study how people actually based on data, as opposed to how people ought to behave based on the quote, big quotes, laws of economics. And people used to get Nobel Prizes for how people should behave, and I was very happy that, but right now, Danny Kahneman got a Nobel Prize for his work in behavior. One of you talked to me, who was it who was going to Colorado to marketing? You, okay. And we had Idamar Sanz in the DSB. Idamar is also a friend of Danny's, the sort of one group of people, Dan Arrighetti as well, who are all people who study how people make decisions. And so what this field is about is how actually people behave. So basically, we now are able to get to this second order effects, and here's the experiment I want. So the experiment took place at Vegas in Menlo Park. And the first setting, we had 6 jams, and Stanford undergraduates pretending to be random shoppers, watched very carefully how many people are coming into the shop, clicked on each person coming in, and clicked on each person who is coming to the table. And then they had coupons, $1 off if they use this coupon within a week, and they quota and ethnicity on those coupons. Okay, so you get the feeling. You go to you go to Dragos, you just think, you know, that's to try out. Little do you know what's really happening. So I'm just presenting with the results. 40% of the customers at Dragos stopped by and checked out the jams. This means tried at least one of the jams in the setting of 6 jams on the table. Okay? The so-called conversion rate, which is the percent who checked something out, actually buying something, was 30%. That's the start. Are you with me? Okay. On the other day, they put 24 jams on there. And actually 60% of the people in this extended choice set, 60% of the people coming actually tried one of those jams. To be honest, I have never seen a jam on the table. I would be curious about some of these flavors too. Probably the kiwi, you know, mango mix or whatever it is. Question, however, here is not jam. What do you think the conversion rate is? More choice. What's the conversion rate? 10% anything. I give you a hint. The first digit is a 3. And the only digit is a 3. So one of the big questions really is, how should we deal with complexity online? Because if you go to a dating site, since that was the example where most of you seem to be engaged in here, if you go to a dating site and it says, here are the people you might want to meet. Is that better, or should we give you the data set where it says, oh, well, here are 500 people who you might want to meet? Everything has been studied. So Dan already studied that, actually. It's better for the data set to only show you a few people. What we did at Match.com is, it was not an experiment, we just measured it says you found 7 matches this week. So we plot it as a function of x, where we have an x of matches presented to you. On y, we have the opening rate of that email. So people see the header, and then what's the probability of them opening the email? And it turned out that while people stated, oh, they were much happier if they get lots of matches, people always had the psychology, oh, that's great, I would deal when I have time. And then, of course, in this world of, you know, dropping stuff, people didn't get to it.
So too complex things, too many choices are not a good thing. People state, revealed preferences versus state preferences, people state that they do want to have a large set of choices. Overvalue options. Yes?
Is there a conversion rate for people who get stuff by?
We don't know that. At that point, all that was happening was people got their voucher, $1 off, and we know that those people bought if they used the voucher. So between those two experimental setups, we hope that the bias is the same one, that some people like me, I always forget that I've asked that. So, but we hope that that doesn't make a difference whether you had the voucher and lost it in the first case of the 6 choice versus the second case of the 24 choices. The way you set up these experiments is, and that's sort of very much the physics view, is that you have to compare things. If you try to do them in an absolute way, there are just so many extra factors that will kill you. But if you do them in a comparable way, that you do ratios like you did it over there, then usually things are under control.
Well, because I'm just wondering if there's a difference, you know, people just stop and buy Gravity Jam in their way or from Match.com, where people would just click on other people randomly, like the extra people matches.
Don't know the question, but what I'm sure about is that we don't have a ground truth yet model of complexity in online settings. And we still have an hour today, so I will bring in class later when I talk about experiments that the only way to deal with this, and that's why I love behavior economics and have problems with people who, you know, tell you whether it's that way or not, is that you just have to set up the experiments well. And then you just simply come up with these are the metrics that in, and then given those metrics and a clean experimental setup, that's the result I want to drive. And then the only question, and that's a hard question, which is left is, it's easy to measure short-term effects, but it's hard to measure long-term effects. That's where the modeling has to come. Those of you who have some background in time series, you know about left sensor distribution and right sensor distribution, all of that. All of that knowledge, if you ever have accumulated, will be handy in such cases. And if you haven't accumulated, don't worry about it now. Since we're talking about complexity, I just want to show you another couple of examples here. Should you do one item a day? Com. Who of you has been to Woot? Yeah. What did you buy?
I haven't bought anything. Oh, I did. I bought a wireless keyboard.
Okay, so why did you first think you didn't buy anything and then you remembered that you actually did buy something?
Well, I was trying to remember. It was a while ago and I was trying to remember all that.
Okay. So Woot has one item a day. So for instance, today is ZR500 mini DVD camcorder for $179.99 with $5 shipping. And that's it. That's the only item they sell. Good price. If you call our customer service and say, you know, I bought that item, they'll sell it on eBay if you don't like it. We have nothing to do with returns. Because it's probably still a better price than you can buy it, you know, normally in the shop. So that's one extreme. Now, why do people go and buy stuff at Woot.com? Who knows? Maybe it's people who are interested in good deals. Irrespective of whether it's a camcorder or whatever you bought, and typewriter or whatever they buy. Now, the other example, Zazzle. Who knows Zazzle? Okay, so Zazzle is, I think, one of the company with the coolest people. It's right on High Street. Zazzle has millions of products. I think that Zazzle has 100,000 designs because you can make your own product. Anybody wants to do a class t-shirt or, you know, anything, have other people help you with that. It is really just the opposite. It's just basically an infinite number of products you can buy at Zazzle. And there is, between these two extremes, everything under the sun in between. For instance, I looked at a website by chance the other day because somebody told me about it, which had, I think, 250 sneaker companies selling stuff on that website. And then I looked up a German company. And there were I think 480 types of Adidas shoes, not counting different sizes. So it's fascinating to just to look at this one question of complexity. So what I wanted to show you here was that different customers probably have different attitudes to complexity, and if you can measure that, just one little field on what you want to know about your customers. Okay. That was the little story about the complexity. Other areas are attitude to technology versus humans. Some people like to talk to people, other people like to talk to computers. If you get this wrong, both sides are unhappy. I want to talk to a computer, why human right now? Activity across stores. How is it you're leaving us?
I have to make this phone call, sorry. I'll let you stay. No,
okay.
Okay.
Will you come next week?
I promise.
Okay, good. Price sensitivity. How do people trade their time off versus their price? Are people willing to buy anything if it's $5 off, so you can experiment with vouchers there? Or are people not willing to buy something because they just don't have the time to explore other things? Then the time between clicks, and also the basic level of curiosity about the world, the willingness to explore stuff. I have lots of examples for all of those, but I think it's better to go on. Because the top level is the most interesting one, and that is the customer network value, which I already mentioned. So there, the question is, what do you do with social network research to figure out who are the influencers, who are the powerful people? There's one story which goes to the media about Amazon, which happened in the late 90s. And it happened to result in Jeff Bezos having an airplane and testify in Washington that he is not discriminating. So you might wonder what happened. Pricing is actually an act which is very unclear in this world. How should you price things? How should you price digital goods? One of the textbooks I mentioned in the list which you have in front of you, based on it, is this wonderful textbook by, yes, the second one, Shapiro and Varian, called Rules. It's almost 10 years old. It's amazing how long it really survived in the bookshelf. And three chapters, chapter I think 2, 3, and 4, are pricing digital goods. And digital goods are priced by having high initial costs and low marginal costs. So let's say a movie. Making a movie is very expensive. But then just distributing the movie digitally is almost free. So that's an example of a digital good. So when it comes to pricing, in many cases, actually, there's more information component to a good than you think. Airline tickets. Airline tickets are very much of an information good because you need to know if the seats are still able on, are still free on that airplane. So when I wanted to get from Singapore to Frankfurt last week, there was no any flight on SQ from Singapore to Europe. So I had to go connecting with Swiss and then with Lufthansa and off. So seats, where you think, you know, butt and seat and, you know, really big aircraft and stuff like this, have a large information component to them. Classes are primarily information. So if you really think about it this way, then you will find many, even, you know, the vegetables you buy in the supermarket have information component to them. Namely, where was that, you know, big box of bananas which I got yesterday? And it's probably rotting somewhere in the back of the store. But remember where you put it. So there are lots of information components to goods which are not even digital goods, but physical goods. So this here. We at Amazon try to find out what is the price we can charge for an item. And a good for doing this is that okay. So you offer the item at different discount levels over there. Let's say minus 10%, minus 20%, minus 30%. And you measure how many people buy it. So your favorite book on minus 10%, this many people, minus 10, presumably a large number of people, and minus 30, even a larger number of people. That is the sales you make.
their profit in the minus 30% is much smaller, maybe whatever, 20% smaller than minus 10. So you superimpose this of sales with a profit curve. And it is like this, that the largest one in the middle, then you know you're doing well with 20%. If, on the other hand, it's monotonically decreasing, then you will make actually no need for the minus 30% discount, and you move like a comb, you move the whole thing over to understand better about what your customer is willing to pay. Are you okay with this? Do you need an explanation? Yes, ask me.
How come it's possible for the sales guy when you get a bigger discount?
The sales go up, but this curve, quote unquote, the line that drew the curve, that's the profits you make. So you have a smaller number, which you multiply with more people. And it's not clear whether that is more or less, and a bigger number multiplied with less people. So that's where you need to empirically simply measure it. So, I mean, one of the quotes some people say about me that I have no idea, but I can measure it. So that's a beautiful thing. I have no idea, but I can measure it. So what happened to Amazon is that that was the case for some DVDs in the late 90s. And already at that stage, interaction, bulletin boards were very active. So people quickly found out, those people were interested in the good deals, that there were some deals to be had on Amazon.com. And they wrote about it. And then other people found that they didn't get those deals. So they felt they were discriminated against. And then Jeff had to say, no, we're not discriminating on gender or race or the popular topics of discrimination are in the United States. We are simply doing experiments. And from that day on, Amazon said that whatever we are doing, since then no experiment has been done. If we ever do an experiment again, we make sure that at the end of the experimental period, we give the money back to everybody who didn't pay the minimum amount. We give them back the difference between what they paid and what the least person paid in the experiment. So that's an example where something which was not discriminatory wasn't accepted by the general public. And our consequence of now saying, well, we of course don't give the same book three different prices. But how would we develop that? Say, here are groups of basic equivalent books, let's say science fiction paperbacks from the 90s or something like this. And then in what we call the equivalence class, we now say, minus 10% for those randomly assigned, minus 10% for those randomly assigned, minus 10% for those randomly assigned. And now we in data without Jeff having to go and test it by performance. That was the little story about this network. And another example which we did here brings more about point, which we had behind the quote when I talked about the architects of experimentation. So we designed some way, and it was called Share the Love. Did anybody of you know the Share the Love feature of Amazon.com? Okay. So, Ben, how work, do you remember, or should I explain it?
You could recommend it to a friend, a book that you just purchased, and then you and they get 10%
yes.
If they follow the recommendation. Great for textbooks.
Absolutely right. So, how it works. What's your name?
Jacob.
Jacob. Jacob buys a book. Let's say my book on time series prediction. And as Jacob, not before he has paid, after he has paid, of course you don't want to put any stumbling blocks in the room. After he has paid, say, hey Jacob, do you have any buddies who might be interested in that book of time series you are? And if you actually have some, if at least one of them buys the book within the case, we give you, because we love you very nice business, we give you 10% credit for your next purchase. And your friends don't think that you are selling them like a pip. We also give them 10% discount on their purchase. And by the way, we might also find a new customer. At least we'll sell another book that way. But that was not the main purpose. The main purpose was to know who the influencers are. Because there are some people who use the service and buy, like professors, tell their students, buy this book, and they sell lots of books. So, what is the actionability Amazon.com towards such people who are influencers? What can Amazon.com do? What actions? About data mining is good to get insights, but the question is always, what actions can you do? So now we found out Jacob, he's a man who has, you know, ways to influence people. What could Amazon do for him?
Giving discounts.
Yeah, giving discounts. Or, yes?
We're getting involved in some beta customer program and getting to write some reviews, so bring him more on the site so a lot of people will know him for a big company.
Yeah, and we know that Jacob influences people. So when Jacob calls up customer service and says, you know, I ordered this Palm Trio 700, whatever it is now, and it didn't arrive, then customer service, you know, knows well. Because if we say, what are you talking about? You know, anybody can claim that. That's not a good thing. Oh, so let's send you two, just in case, you know, if you want to make sure. Do you maybe have another friend who wants one as well? Versus if somebody isn't quite in that, you know, league, somebody always complains. So Amazon has a model for each customer. It's grouped by decile, how much the, you know, how well the customer should be treated. And I looked that up for myself. You know, I haven't shared that in public yet. So I looked that up for myself, and I found myself in decile. I found myself in that group of customers who ought to be fired. Because, you know, I have a really good feeling of when something is actually worth buying, when I get it. So Amazon actually wasn't particularly interested in having me the customer when I looked that up. So in my case, if I call them up and say, you know, they would say, what's this? And, you know, connection, can't hear you. Hello? Hello? So that's the space. I'm not saying this in particular, since broadcast farmers would ever do that. But that's the space of actionability you have. You have much more as you believe you do have. Yes?
But can they measure price elasticity?
So price, you should define it. Because economics, right, got the axes wrong. So if you're an economist, I mean, if you're a normal person, then you think it should be price on the x-axis and demand on the y-axis. Economists did it the other way around. So what they have is the first derivative. I always, as a normal person, have to sort of twist. Which way was elasticity defined? It was the slope of the reverse curve, essentially, right? But this is an interesting question, because Amazon ultimately doesn't want to know about price elasticity. Amazon make more profits. And so what Amazon does, it directly measures the profit as a function of the price. So this is a good point. So let me repeat this for everybody. So economists have price elasticity, and I was just considering whether it's true. I have like a half hour. I don't want to spend the half hour on this right now. So you could build models of that, and it's actually important to know these things. But the world we live in is this world of this bidirectional communication, where things come back to you. So experiments will give you much more than having mass elasticity. So thank you for the question, because it beautifully illustrates the point of this class, that through click data, you can measure things which you would have a hard time modeling ahead of time. While we are at pricing, let me insert 2 minutes on something which is very important in this world of digital goods, and that's versioning. So, quick product. If you have a digital product, digital goods product, like, let's say, email, getting email, you know, and getting places.com, you don't know what people are willing to pay for it. So the way it is that you offer different price levels, but of course not by whether you're a student or not, because, you know, anybody can claim that they're a student. But of course by letting people self-select it. So group pricing is if it's based on your properties. For instance, 15 years ago when I was in China first, I, as a foreigner, had to pay twice as much for the airline seat compared to the person sitting next to Chinese national. That was the notion of group pricing. Foreigner pays twice as much as Chinese person. Makes sense, right? They stopped a few years ago, and now it's subversioning. I can sit in economy, or I can sit in business. And I select and the corresponding seat. But I pay the same as the guy sitting next to me, because they don't have any yield management in China yet. Of course, in United, or, you know, U.S. airlines or Western airlines, there is complicated yield management trying to figure out how many seats will they sell, and then you pay, you know, more or less depending on what they expect to be in yield management. So versioning is important. So when you build a digital product, then you have about how can you create different versions of it. And for instance, if you, let's say, have images, if you have your Flickr pictures and you don't buy them, then you might have a low-resolution version for very little money, and the really full high-resolution version of 12 megabytes that you charge more for.
or sound bias. Or another example of versioning are data about stocks. So typically you get them with a 15-minute delay. But if you want to have them in real time, you have to pay for it.
So it's just something you put in the back of your mind when you talk to the, we do experiments, we measure things. And what's more important than that is when you have digital products, then not only measure varying things through self-selection. Self-selection is another important point, actually, that we talked about works before.
One of the big differences is that on the internet, people self-select into groups. I did a consulting project for the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum is that group of mostly white old men who meet once a year in Davos, many very rich white old men who meet in Davos in January and, you know, talk about global warming and things like this to make, you know, an impact on the world, as Klaus Schwab, the CEO of the World Economic Forum. And they wanted to build a social network. And I thought, great idea. So I got my friends together, like Joshua Schachter, and people who are great thinkers. And basically, we questioned the initial assumption that you define the group by excluding people, by saying, if you think about what's happening in Web2O, what's happening in these collaborative architectures, it's precisely the long tail of the distribution. People who do not belong to the almost dead rich white men who you invite to Davos, but who might be, you know, not yet, and not white, and not men. So if you contribute, they might know more about, let's say, microfinancing in India than other guys. And they told us, no, we are going to participate by exclusion, and thank you very much, but this is not what we wanted. We get an ad agency, and they will advertise that we now have the solution to world hunger and all of that. So it's very interesting to see how those groups shifted, and the point I wanted to make is, Joshua's point actually was, we made the point, that we self-select into groups. So our friend who is no longer here in class today, because he didn't make it, who said, you know, he has friends at Facebook. Facebook is an example where you self-select it. And I don't know actually what groups people and how many groups people typically are in, but I do know that it's hardly ever the case. You go somewhere because you need to subscribe to that. You know, actually at Stanford is this parking. I mean, the one group I never would consider because I actually hardly am on car on campus is this parking mailing list. And I'm not sure whether anybody who teaches at Stanford regularly gets updates on the parking list. It's about as exciting as when I was at Amazon, the toilet room closings. So if another room, some site, somewhere, and the toilet needs to be cleaned, I got an email update for that. So that's not what I mean by self-selection. I want to make sure I point of experiments, because this is one which is close to my heart. And I think bringing that point is a couple of slides which are pretty good for that. Okay, Amazon.com. You know this page, which has changed not very much over the years. And so this button, even if you can't read it, says add to shopping cart. So you click that button. Here's the button. Yes, it's over here. I just discovered it, actually. This makes more sense than just looking, talking to the screen. So I click on that button, and what shows up is a new page, which has the item I just shopped on. And the question I have for you now is, we want to make recommendations. There are two kinds of recommendations. One kind of recommendation are compliments, things you buy in addition to what you add to your shopping cart. The other one are substitutes, things you could buy what you just add to your shopping cart. I told you about that matrix over there. What matrix do you use for compliments? Compliments, exactly, correct, have purchase data, correct. Whereas substitutes have click data on them, browse data. Okay. There's actually one really cool feature I'm quite proud of, which is the between click data and purchase data. So I don't think I have a slide here. If you go down, it will tell you people click this item, eventually purchase that item. Pretty cool, because it takes what Amazon's interested in, namely selling new stuff, and it captures you really as your process of creating and maintaining product space awareness. Hey, it says, and by the way, people click on this item eventually end up buying that item. Very interesting. I just did it for a few books when I wrote the textbooks for the class, and I recommended Chris Bishop's book for that. It's very interesting to see the funnel that people see this other book and then all end up buying Chris Bishop's book. So just very powerful how you get through these implicit data and you learn about people, the explicit recommendation, which actually really makes a difference to the world. It's called consumer surplus. And people expect that you can sell twice as much in terms of if you just have people find, discover the right books. Amazon developed something called Blue Book. And then search inside the book. And you start a very secret option. It's done in your company. Pages were scanning and oh, not an easy problem, because how can you use all the computers Amazon has, 10,000 of computers, doing distributed OCR? And then, you know, the first pages came out, and the big publishers, of course, said, oh, you can't do this. And we said, we do an experiment. And it turned out the probability of selling a book which has searchable OCR content is 7% higher than selling the same book without people discovering that book. You wouldn't believe how quickly the publishers were quite happy letting Amazon actually use the search inside the book. And how just measuring stuff can bring long arguments otherwise to a very quick ending. But I want to talk about it right now, much simpler. So we constructed this page here, the page where we have recommendations on the left-hand side, and the shopping side. Or should it be the other way around? That we have the recommendations on the right and shopping on the left. How do we, what do you think? Who thinks of this way? Okay, it's about half of the people. And who thinks this way? Okay. So now what should we do, arm wrestling? So, of course, the answer is experiment. Now, one of the important lessons today is that before we engage in experiments, we have to be very clear what the metrics are, what the things are that we're measuring. So I've talked about click data a number of times today, but what I have not talked about is what are the things we try to optimize? So at Amazon.com's case, it could be, of course, the stock price. But it's a little difficult to know whether putting on the left side or putting on the right side has a positive effect or negative effect on the stock price. I wish we knew. It's a little far, you know, in the propagation of the results. So we measure other things here. For instance, we take our old friend, the conversion rate, like at Dragos. Or we could say the order size, how many items from the circuit page, from this recommender page, actually get added. And then it turns out that actually that half of you who said the shopping cart on the right-hand side were right. And it's a 1% effect. So it's not important that the shopping cart on the right-hand side is doing better than the left-hand side. What is important is two things. One, being really clear about the metrics is very, very important. When I work with startups, when I work with companies, discussion about the metrics is always the same thing. They think they don't need the discussion. And then once one has the discussion, it becomes very clear to them that different or reasonable smart people around the table implicitly try to optimize different things. For instance, one guy tries to optimize conversion rate. Not an uncommon thing. Trying to optimize conversion rate, I think every company has, you know, some person who is watching conversion rates. Another guy, to optimize page impressions. Not an unreasonable thing either. Companies, Google, Yahoo, live of people getting paid. those two guys often have opposite actions. For instance, if I get paid by optimizing page impressions, hey, I bet just any keyword in the universe, or you know, enter free sound, and then voila, you know, people come like, you know, hotcakes. It is not good for the conversions if I'm trying, say, sell books in action, because it's not really what people wanted to get when they read them those terms. On the other hand, the guy who is being paid for optimizing conversion rate, well, he would be best served if he just sells one book at the first hit in the year and then shuts that because he has a conversion rate of 100%. So the point I'm making is that the conversation about the metrics is a very important question, because one, you see trade-offs like the one I just explained right up early up front, and two, you have much easier agreement on the metrics, then you have these emotional agreements whether it should be the right-hand side or the left-hand side. So in this case, it is about a 1% effect. Yes?
Okay, so for instance, from the last one about the OCR, circle OCR. So when it turns, do you do it with the audience, or do you put it on the site first?
Okay. So, an experiment of, let's say, selling umbrellas. That's a very good experiment in San Francisco. I live in San Francisco. Today, when I was driving down there, beautiful sunny day. Yesterday, it was rainy. If you do these experiments sequentially, let's say yesterday you are selling red umbrellas, today you are selling blue umbrellas. And we laugh because you know that you have other effects which have nothing to do with the red versus the blue. You can't do it sequentially, because these are typically 1% effects, and the largest effects, which are way more than 1%. Not as dramatic as selling umbrellas in San Francisco, but for instance, day of week. People just behave differently on Saturday. Saturday is the least busy day at Amazon. Then they behave on Monday, when the pent-up demand, they're finally back at the office, their wife doesn't bother them anymore, and they can buy all these things. So you have to do that. Experimental design is an area which goes back about 100 years. Who's teaching the experimental design class this year, do you know?
We haven't offered one in a while.
One in a while, okay. So there's a book, Yellow Book by Montgomery, on the design of experiments. And unfortunately, most of it, I like it. I say it's a good book and people get their pens on and write down the book. But I have to say, unfortunately, most of that is good for e-business. Why? What people really were famous for 100 years ago is design experiments with certain constraints. For instance, if you have to, let's say, study genetics, then maybe even if you take rabbits, even rabbits take a while to reproduce. So there are time constants which are given by expert things. Or you want to improve the quality of rice in Thailand, then you have just to wait for a couple of generations of rice to be produced. Secondly, it was not only the time scale, but the cost of subjects used to be pretty high. So you might have to pay $10 to get someone to come into your lab at Stanford to do with Fields and Bartle, the prison experiment in the 70s. None of those constraints apply to e-business, to the internet. In other words, the one something million people coming each day to Amazon, they come for free. You don't have to pay them. Actually, they pay you. Or to Google. So you don't have to have a sample of people you pay and you worry about how to draw the sample. You have everybody coming in. So market research, it's in a way of, you worry really who do you sample. Nielsen, I think, samples 5,000 people. Or Harris Poll, something like 5,000 in the United States. No need for it. Everybody who you have as a customer is coming to your side as a customer. And the second thing is that the time scales for instance, designing a new packaging for a toothpaste used to be about a half year until the results come in. Here, it's no longer a question of months. It's a question of minutes. So the answer to your question is, the most important thing is you run it in parallel. The second most important thing is those things which, you know, famous old statisticians all then told you is important, were important at the time, super important, but matter no more, where it's free to have subjects, where it's free to run experiments. The one somewhat case worth considering might be the interaction between experiments. But all these Latin hypercubes, all these things that statisticians know about. But in the world, again, where you have just lots and lots of people, it is easy to be worse than chance. So I've worked with many people who were too stubborn good and trying to figure out how to do that in an experiment because they didn't want to do it at random with their assigned one. And it found out, you know, it turned out down the road that it was, you know, some bias which they bought in by trying to be very smart, which actually results, as opposed to them just, you know, assigning randomly to people. So how do you do this random assigning? If you want to have 3% of all customers show up at a certain site, how would you pick 3% of all customers at random? But move, please, this up to this level that you project the slide, but I could also write, I mean, great. So how do you, for instance, pick 10% of the customers at random? Okay, great. How do you pick 3% of the customers at random? You pick the customers before they arrive. So just to be clear, if you say every third customer today out of 100, if you take 3 out of 100, so 1 to 3 and the rest, the remaining 97, see the other thing. Then 1 to 3 remaining, or when 1 of 30 has the problem, what problem does it have? That you have a higher bias towards customers who come very frequently to the site. Maybe you want it, maybe you don't want it. So it's unclear. I'm just pointing out that that's a bias towards it. So if you sample every 30th person coming to the site, the result is that people who come very frequently to the site will have more of a vote in what you're measuring than if you just want to sample randomly from the population. Maybe if you take, for instance, in airlines, you maybe want to have frequent flyers having more of a vote than that person who has his United Airlines frequent flyer card, never flies United. What you do is, you take the custom ID, or you map it, you hash it, United number. So this is your frequent flyer number, or that's your Amazon ID. You might not even know this, but in your computer, deep down, things are represented by numbers. And then you say these are 10 digits. You randomly, first of all, pick one of these, and it ought to be this one, okay? And then you randomly pick another digit. This digit goes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 9. And you randomly say, ah, it turns out to be a 3. And if you now pick those guys, everybody who has a 3 in here, you get 10%, right? If you hashed it into a random distribution, uniform distribution. So 10% is more than you want half. You want 3%. So how do you get 3%? What do you do next? Get another number. If it's the same one, tough again, but it happens to be this one, okay? And then you pick another random number and it turns out to be a 2. So now you only have 1%. You pull two random numbers here and then you have 3%. So that is sort of the tricks, not very deep tricks, but the reasonable things you want to do. But if you have a little company, you never want to start your customers counting with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, because that way your competitor knows by looking at the customer how many people they have. But you always want to have sort of random, without repetition, you know, start with 10 million customers, and wow, I'm already 5 million in AMS, lots of people there. Let's try to take stock here. Do you have any questions before I start? Actually, let me grab questions first and then I'll do my summary. Yes?
Can you talk about the homework?
Yeah, I do logistics at the end. While we're still concentrated, I want to do my summary. Ready? Or any other questions? Content questions?